I'm opening. We have an eye, part of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another Anatomy of the Movie. This week brought to you by Maria Menounos' latest new New York Times bestseller, The Every Girl's Guide to Diet and Fitness. Thank you, Maria. This week we'll be dissecting Edge of Tomorrow, the latest summer blockbuster starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, directed by Doug Liman and scored by a very special guest, Christoph Beck.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us in the studio. Appreciate
you
being here.
It's truly my pleasure. Thanks.
So we're going to talk about the movie. We'll break down a few of the bits of it. Then we'll talk to Christoph about his career and a bunch of other things that which we can try to glean out from him or to get out of him as best we can. But
get
in the meantime,
ready.
I want to introduce the panel. To my left here is Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
We also have Sarah Stretton.
Hi, guys.
And in the booth is Phil. Will you be joining us?
Not today.
Okay.
Just from the booth.
So first thing I want to know is overall impressions. And I'd like to start with Christoph, or Chris, as he's known by all the friends back in Canada. when you first saw it with, I assume you saw it with Temp Track or no?
I did see it with Temp Track.
Okay.
But they hadn't spent a lot of time on the temp, and It was mixed so low that I thought...
It was buried?
It was buried. For example, all those battle sequences, the four or five first repetitions of that scene on the beach... The music was mixed so low I couldn't even hear it. So
wow.
I thought, oh, that's an interesting choice to just play a completely like cinema verite. But but it was just because they weren't really comfortable with the temp, and it was just kind of there doing its job in minimalist fashion.
So in that form that you saw, what was your initial response to it? I mean, how did you come to it? How did you receive it?
I loved it. I mean, it's I was talking to Sarah earlier before the show. I often don't get to see the movie before I take a job. Now, this movie being the type of movie that it was, the thought never entered into my mind that I wouldn't do it. But it was still an enormous relief to see the movie for the first time and to see just in what good shape it was.
Oh, that's great.
And it's pretty different from the movie that we see in theaters today. But the core of it and the story of it and the Tom Cruise amazing performance of it was all there to see. And I was just really, really pumped up.
Do you mind telling us what that running time roughly was, that first version?
I don't even know. I think it might have even been shorter
than what
we see now.
So yeah,
I know there was a late
minutes running time now.
Is that right?
113.
It might have been a little shorter. I know they played around a lot with a few different sequences, long, complete sequences in the movie, out of the movie, and they ended up putting a whole like 8-9 minute sequence back in pretty late in post production. So I wonder if it was shorter or longer when I saw it.
And you liked it, loved it, and initially, right away, we're going, yeah, I want to score this.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's like, I'm on board.
Right.
I'm happy.
Yeah.
We're good.
I mean, it's a big step for me personally. I've done a lot of movies, most of them comedies, and you know,
Hangover being a huge one.
Correct. And many others like it. And you know, for me, this is the first opportunity to do a big summer tentpole that wasn't a comedy, that was in a genre that I happen to love. I love sci-fi. I love especially this movie, which is you know, kind of a hard sci-fi time travel movie.
With aliens. Taboo.
Totally.
Yeah.
And you know, you got to give props to Tom Cruise for keeping the torch alive, the sci-fi torch alive to some extent. It was incredibly exciting.
I didn't know you were a sci-fi fan. That's great. All right, let's get to your impressions, Sarah.
All right, overall impressions. I have to say that I'm joining on, I feel like, the constant review of this movie, which was everyone is so pleasantly surprised.
Right.
And I really, really enjoyed it. I love sci-fi. And some of the movies we've seen lately haven't really been living up to what I would expect of them. Transcendence.
Okay.
Sorry. But I think that Tom Cruise's performance, how they approached time in this movie, how my favorite component was that they did make the reliving of this day feel long, feel like a struggle, feel like there is ups and downs. They gave an emotional impact to how many times he was reliving that. And to me, that really sunk in, and how much emotional crossover there was, where I felt like his relationship with Emily Blunt had had all these other moments that we didn't get to see, mm-hmm. I really enjoyed. And I thought the timing, the pacing, everything was put together really well. And it's a movie I look forward to seeing again.
Well, you said The Longest Day was interesting because it was released in America on June 6th, which obviously is the anniversary of D-Day, and I thought they wanted to make it feel like The Longest Day for real. All right, so Marissa, what did you think?
Yeah, and, you know, you just mentioned D-Day. It mm-hmm. felt like a storming of Normandy when they landed on the beach. I really did like this film. I myself am a sci-fi fan too, but I'm a big fan of non-linear stories because mm-hmm. I feel they always make the audience think in ways, yeah. and that really, if done well, it'll keep audience still engrossed in the story, still trying to figure it out, all the mm-hmm. characters, everything yeah. that's going on. And I thought it was really brilliant how they edited and just kept the story going, even though time was resetting,
yeah.
but every time you see it progress a little bit forward, mm-hmm. and I thought that was so well done. And the only time we can really see time move and use effectively is in film, is in photographs. We can see things, how they change over time, mm-hmm. and I felt this movie really played with that. And even going back, yes, like Sarah, you mentioned the emotional struggles that we can see humor in it as well. Mm-hmm. Like how many times he's getting frustrated and because he's doing it over and over again, but he still, it was just so well done. And mm-hmm. I love nonlinear and it was yeah. great.
I agree. I love nonlinear films that jump in time and space. They're always fun. And I thought this was great at that. And a lot of times Tom's behind this curve because he doesn't know where he is. And then sometimes he's way ahead of us because we don't know he's taken 100. I've done this. I've killed you 100 times. And we go, oh, it's been that many? Mm-hmm. We don't even, as an audience, we don't know that. So
and how they play with, when they do expand the scene from the beach to whether it's the farmhouse, how right. they don't always take you back to his first experience in it. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, when we do get to the helicopter scene, they could have played that off as, oh, it's their first time there each time. It's their first time at this location. It's the first time. But sometimes they bring you in introducing, like, oh, we've missed that they've been here yeah. so many times.
And that's one of the things. I'm sorry, did you have
no, we're right ahead.
The other thing I wanted to, because how do you do that as a composer? I mean, first of all, you've got well over 100 films to your credit. So how do you keep from repeating yourself, especially in this movie? How do you, what's the technique?
Well, I'll just
talk
about this movie.
Okay.
We talked a lot about how to approach the repetition.
Yeah.
And I do that in a number of ways. One of the ways is at certain key moments, not all the time, but at certain mm-hmm. key moments, we play the same or almost the same music mm-hmm. for the same scenario.
It's coming back to the same point. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a little bit of a change of color mm-hmm. or sometimes it's a change of key to make it feel like we're going a little bit forward. Mm-hmm. But you really feel in a few key spots the repetition of the music, which reinforces the repetition of what you're seeing, mostly in the comedic moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm doing that, but also in one of the main themes of the movie, I wrote a tune that was 8 notes mm-hmm. long or 10 notes long, and I presented in the piece. Okay, here's the first note, mm-hmm. and then I start over. Okay, here's note number one, note number two, uh-huh. and then I do 3 notes, and then sort of build on the theme that way, mm-hmm. which is it's a little bit of a intellectual conceit. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure anyone, you know, your average person seeing the movie, I don't know if they're going to, interesting mirroring of the structure of the film and the structure of the tune. But that was the idea.
So did you have to map it out as you're...
No, it wasn't quite that specific. Okay. It was really more of a feel our way through experiment. Yeah. I was on this movie for a good 5-6 months. So,
long?
That is long. That's unusually long for me. I'm usually about on a movie about half that length of time. Uh-huh. But it really gave us time to experiment. You know, I wrote a lot of different versions of a lot of the key scenes, and that was a constant source of discussion. You know, how do we play against the repetition? Mm-hmm. You know, because when even in the movie when things repeat, there's something different about the scene. There's a forward motion in the storytelling, and how much of that do we want reflected in the music?
Is that workshop approach mostly because it's kind of how Doug works, or is that because of the nature of this particular piece, we had to do it that way?
I think it's the nature of the business and the job. It is so difficult to talk about music.
Yeah.
I mean, I could play a piece of music for you, mm-hmm. and you might only be able to tell me if you like it or if you don't, and you might not even be able to tell me that, mm-hmm. or you might be able to go into some detail, and maybe you have some ear training or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's just I've seen this quote attributed to lots of different people, but it goes something like talking about music is like dancing about architecture. I'm sure you guys have heard that before. It really is true in this case. So, and with Doug, there is a bit more of a, I'm not sure what I want, but I'll know it when I hear it type of a thing. So there was a, certainly an initial struggle in the first month or two, trying to get inside of his head and trying to shed some of my my old habits.
And there's also, I mean, I don't know this, but I'm guessing, at least in my mind, my ear, if I hear something, it's different than when I hear it and see it at the same time. Did you, I mean, do you always have to see it while you're hearing it to really get the full effect of it?
Yeah, you know, I'm not making records. I'm making scores. So, it's really all about that.
Yeah,
It's totally picture and story driven.
It has to be. Okay.
Now, occasionally I can take a step back and turn off my dialogue track and just enjoy a piece of music for what it is, a piece of music.
Sure.
But that's, you know, I can't let myself get seduced by that too much. I have to really think about, okay, but does this do what it needs to do for this story?
When you say you create versions and you, like, you present them, do you have a place where your gut's at and you're trying, or are you trying to really accommodate the director's vision?
Well, both. I mean, I'm always trying to accommodate the director's vision. Occasionally I will have ideas that go counter to that, and in which case multiple versions is a great way of presenting that. You know, okay, here's the way you want it.
But look how this, how do you like it?
Yeah.
But now check this out. Maybe this is the opposite of what you asked for, but maybe this is better. And I, you know, most filmmakers, sure, they get married to ideas, but they genuinely want to make the movie as good as they can. And they're open to that sort of thing. So, yeah. All right.
And you said 5 to 6 months on this. When were you brought into the process? After filming had been completed? Or
yes.
While it was, oh, okay.
After principal filming had been completed. Okay. There were a couple of little reshoots that they did here and there during post. But a few months really after they finished shooting.
Okay.
Yeah. They had a very long post on this movie.
They had a very
almost
long
a year.
Production. Yeah.
They kept resetting for some reason.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They had to do it, you know, hundreds of times. Yeah.
What were you saying, sir?
Oh, no. I was just saying that in general, I feel like this movie from concept, like in post-production, pre-production, everything, it took a lot, but there was a lot put into it.
Yeah.
Let's
give the backstory of how it became what it is. It was adapted from a 2004 Japanese novel called All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sakurazaka.
Good luck with
Sakurazaka.
That one.
Hopefully, apologies to if I mispronounced any if I did. It was bought in late night 2009 by 3 Arts Entertainment. Instead of pitching a studio to make the film and buy the rights to make the film, etc., they decided to do a spec script. But they brought on Dante Harper, and which he wrote a script that ended up on the blacklist. And in 2010, it was purchased by Warner Brothers.
And it was purchased for a lot. It was purchased for over a million.
I remember parts from 1 million to 3 million. I don't know if anybody knows, but I'm sure we'll find out.
And then it was proceeded to be a little bit hacked.
Yeah, well, this is what
a lot of people have asked me.
They wanted me to go into more detail about how things go into the screen. So we're just giving this as an example, which is not, well, it is indicative of most scripts in Hollywood. Let's just put it that way. So it was purchased in 2010 by Warner Brothers. It was revised in 2011, was revised again by, was it Joby Harold, to fit Tom Cruise's age, because at the time he wasn't on the script. Now he became on the film. Okay, 6 months after that, or excuse me, 6 months into filming, Lyman discarded 2/3 of Harper's original script, brought in Jez Butterworth and John Henry Butterworth, and they were hired to rewrite. Screenwriter Simon Kinsberg take over after that. 8 weeks before filming, it was replaced by Christoph McQuarrie. So this is common. And even though Dante did the original script, he's not credited because so much of it was changed. So the final credit goes to Jez and John Henry Butterworth and Christoph McQuarrie.
That would be how it happens.
That's how it goes.
And I didn't know any of that.
Yeah, you didn't know. Okay,
no. So that's step how it goes. After step after step.
And they hadn't finished the writing when they started filming. So they were still writing it as they were filming it.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, Chris McQuarrie has worked with Tom on a few things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So lucky and you so get to come in, and that's all kind of dealt with.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's still quite a bit of chaos around the project on a big project like this, of course. But yeah, that was all, you know, water under the bridge by that point.
Mm-hmm. And you're still trying to figure out what you got after you filmed it. It's like, all right, what do we really have here?
So.
Now, you said you when you started on this production, you struggled with the tone of the film. What did you do to overcome that and get started?
Really just a lot of writing and rewriting. And then there was one particular point about 2 or 3 months in when I had made quite a bit of progress, but there were still some obstacles creatively somehow to me, you know, finding a tone that pleased everybody. And mm-hmm. by everybody, that was Doug and Tom at that point. Doug was involved with the scoring process by that point. And it was actually a suggestion of one of the music executives at Warner Brothers that just take 2 weeks off. Like, we don't want to see you for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And just go write music. Turn the picture off and just write music. Thinking about the character, story, or whatever. And I was thinking, I don't know. Is that really going to help? I don't know. But it sounds fun. I don't have to see you guys for 2 weeks. All right, cool. I'll go do that. That was a bit of a breakthrough for me. Mm-hmm. I think I wrote really only three pieces during that time, but all three ended up in the movie. Mm-hmm. And one of them ended up being the solution to a nut I was trying to crack with the comedy, how to play the comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done, as you pointed out, a ton of movies. A lot of them are comedies. I feel like I'm the comedy expert. But this movie was... The humor was obviously incredibly important.
Yeah.
And you guys all mentioned how refreshing it was and something unexpected in the film. To have the right touch with that was really important.
Mm-hmm.
And things went, you know, a lot smoother after that.
So it was the so-called break or whatever.
Yeah, that what allowed piece you to cut. Was this?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I actually, the piece as written was supposed to be in the end credits. I don't know if they use it. I don't think they did, but it is the last piece on the soundtrack.
Uh-huh.
And that material also appears in the helicopter scenes. It's kind of almost like a march feel to it, where the low strings are just kind of pounding away.
Mm-hmm.
And it really plays to his... I don't give a crap kind of attitude by that point.
Yeah.
Like, he's just over the whole thing, like, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so it was sort of a bit of a forcefully apathetic march.
That's how it's an adagio, forcefully apathetic, exactly. You know, whatever.
Well, that sounds better in Italian.
Yeah.
What type of, when you were looking at this film, like, finding these little inspirational points, was there any style of music that really... you drew from or held your ear, or any instruments that you really felt propelled your inspiration?
Nothing in particular so much as Doug's really pushing me to try things in a very unconventional way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that led me toward this being a futuristic film with industrial overtones. Those mech suits are you know, they're real, they're not CGI, and
right.
they feel real in the movie, they look great, and so somehow get some of that industrialization and mechanical, metallic type of vibe in the score. And the way we did that was through electronics and synthesizers and spending quite a bit of time making custom-designed sounds that we can then sprinkle a little bit of orchestra around.
But that was the underpinning?
That was the underpinning. Okay. I would say the underpinning is synth-based.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that interesting for you because, I mean, you're a classically trained musician and kind of this influx of how technology...
Graduate
how
of Yale University. Yeah.
And, like, how, like, the synthesizer, how all these, you know, kind of interesting sounds are coming into play now, is that a new challenge you have to, like, learn and become adapted to?
No, because I was into that...
Oh,
probably before I studied classical. I mean, I remember convincing my music teacher to let me take home the one synthesizer they had and then just make homemade recordings with it, you know, as a 13-year-old.
Wow. So you were lucky. You were ahead of the curve on this one.
I've always been into electronic music and the production side of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would work a paper route as a kid, and then my dad very kindly offered to match me dollar for dollar so I could go rent like a 4-track recorder and make horrible 80s love ballads, you know. But I was really always into the production. I loved recording my own stuff. And, of course, as you pointed out, the contemporary style of film scoring incorporates a lot of production techniques and electronics. It's not just put some nice microphones up in front of an orchestra and go.
Yeah.
It's very involved. And I think that because I was so interested in it so early, that's an advantage.
Yeah. And now it's like people want everything. It's like they want the synthesizer at some point. But also, we can't leave out the piano.
Get the strings in there. Like, where's the oboe?
We want everything.
Well, isn't that's sort of a kitchen sink mentality.
Yeah.
But isn't that the case for the entire sound picture of films? You know, they're getting so loud. And so there's no quiet in movies anymore.
Do you struggle finding those times? Or people allowing them?
It is difficult. It takes a brave filmmaker, especially in today's climate, with a Hollywood film. I mean, if you're talking about indie films or foreign films, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, you'd have to be very secure in your movie to do like a Castaway.
That's right.
To let it where just the entire hour and a half middle part of the movie has no score whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it's just all about Tom Hanks's performance. Yeah.
When you see a movie like that, does part of you ever be like, oh, but if there was music here, it would be nice?
Not when it's as well executed as that. I mean, if the movie didn't work or if somehow there was a scene where Tom Hanks's performance was not quite as strong as the others, and you'd be like, okay, maybe a little music would help here. But as a concept, I just really appreciated the elegance of it and the simplicity of it. Just to say, okay, we'll play the beginning and the end, and just this time on the island, and we just want the solitude to be the main thing we feel, not, you know, this syrupy orchestra of strings telling
that's
you to feel
sad.
That's
just wall to wall music. Exactly. Yeah. Manipulating it crazy. But you talked about being unconventional. And so how would you do you approach it in terms of the themes? You know, some of your characters, like Rita has her own thing going. So was that specific?
But that's about it.
That's what I was wondering. Was that, obviously, it seemed like a specific choice. We're not going to go that route.
Right. Definitely.
Okay.
Great example is the scene where Cage finally becomes like a super soldier.
Right.
And after doing this Normandy-style battle dozens, hundreds, however many times, he finally gets to the point where he can really kick ass in the battlefield. Yeah. And they kept saying, he's Superman now. He's Superman now, they being Doug and the other filmmakers. So in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, like the Indiana Jones theme.
Horns.
So I've done like 8 or 10 things. And he's like, no, still too conventional. And finally, he's like, okay, forget about the whole idea of a long line melody. And I created some orchestral effects and sampled them and processed them, distorted them. And basically, at one point, after going back and forth on a lot of these sort of heroic, not quite heroic versions, Doug said, you know, why don't we just forget about superhero? What if he's just like a punk rocker? What if he's just like a rebel and he just doesn't care anymore? So that's what ended up in the movie, a kind of very aggressive, almost industrial, sampled orchestra, hybrid type of thing. Hard to describe.
Well, I think that feeling carries through because that's how I would describe him. Like, if someone came out of that movie being like, oh, Tom Cruise comes out as, you know, the glorious figure, I'd be like, no, it is. It's that it's a little bit darker. It's a little bit more of a frustration.
Yeah. But he's getting dragged, kicking and screaming.
Yeah, because he's a reluctant hero. He goes from a coward to a hero, but he's reluctant pretty much all the way. When he does it for her more than anything, go ahead.
Do you enjoy composing for the storytelling aspect of a film or more for the character development of a certain person?
I think they're one and the same. They're one and the same. I think film scoring is storytelling through music, and sometimes you have to think about it on the macro level. And you think about the overarching story, and other times you take it scene by scene. And that's when you can really get more specific with what a character might be thinking at a particular moment. But those are all decisions, you know, whether to do one or the other musically, that are constantly talked about between me and the director. And we try different things. And sometimes they have a very clear idea what they want to do. If there's a scene with two characters having a conversation, but they're thinking very different things, maybe they have different agendas, the music has to make a choice. And that choice affects the flow of the story. And so... those are the types of decisions. I consider those to be kind of in the same category. Yeah.
And so was your most challenging part of this to try to get away from the convention?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And to find the right sound that rang true to Doug's ears of something that was very original that I still pushed you. Yeah. Also, it's important that I still like it too.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was, I mean, that was the hardest part of it. You know, to put it colloquially, the movie kicked my ass for 6 months, and you know, my ass started to hurt.
Yeah, there you go.
I would do it again in a heartbeat. I would do it again in a heartbeat to get a chance to work on movies of this caliber with filmmakers of this caliber, and if it's, you know, four times as much work as my other films, that's okay. I'm ready.
There you go. Now you, obviously, we talked about how you first came to you and what version you saw. Have you seen the finished version in any form?
I actually have not. Okay. I'm a little embarrassed to say.
No, it's all right. It's all right.
The circumstances.
You've worked on it more than a very long time.
Now, normally, as a film composer, you get did see the movie twice, like in its finished form. Mm-hmm. And the first time would be when they finish their sound mix.
Yeah.
And they invite everyone in to come in and make their comments, and they have a few more days to make final tweaks. Mm-hmm. I'm usually at this playback, mm-hmm. and that's when I get a chance to suggest the music might be too soft, too loud, or if any of the powers that be in the room have any issue with the music, I can be there to help solve problems.
Right.
So I get to see it there in, I would say, 99% finished form, mm-hmm. and then there's usually the premiere.
Right.
In this case, the final mix was in London. I had just gotten back from London after mm-hmm. spending 2 weeks there recording and doing my own music mix. You know, I wasn't going to get back on a plane right. and go back for a 2-hour meeting.
Sure.
You know,
you're like, oh, this is too long of a plane.
6 months I started. Well, I think I can be
you,
done right now.
Well, from when you first saw it to that point where you'd seen the 99% version, how had it changed for you? Was the feeling still there? Were those initial reactions still part of it, or were they?
Well, heightened? I didn't actually ever get to see it.
Oh, I
didn't make it back.
I misunderstood.
Yeah,
that.
I'm saying normally.
Yeah, I misunderstood that.
This was the exception to the rule.
Because I'm based here and the post production was over there.
Right. No, I didn't get it. Now. Yeah. I thought you had
no
been
problem.
There for that, but not for the next one.
And normally the second time I get to see the finished product is the premiere, and in this particular case the premiere was in New York, and it was part of a kind of a crazy stunt for the fans that involved
jet setting,
right?
Jumping
New York,
time
London,
zones, and
right?
Like yeah,
New York, London, and Paris all the same day.
Yeah.
And by the time they got to New York, that was the last one. It was midnight.
Yeah,
on the edge
of tomorrow.
Well, that was the idea, right? Yeah. They did their red carpet, and they went. They came out and they introduced the movie, and then they all went out to dinner. So I'm like, okay, I could go out to dinner with Tom Cruise, or I could see
the
this movie.
Movie
that I've already seen 600 times. Yeah. I'm going to go to dinner.
Yeah.
So
how
I still,
was the dinner? It was supposed to be really lavish.
It was great. It wasn't really lavish. It was pretty small. And it was basically thinking? Just the filmmaking team. Maybe you're thinking of a different
the other
event.
One. Is it the rap?
Yeah.
Rap party.
Yeah. So that was just the executives and the filmmakers and some of the cast. So I never got to see it there either. Mm-hmm. And I've been so busy lately, I haven't got a chance. I was going to take my son.
It's
my
really
wife
good.
Was like, he really wants to see it. I'm taking him. So everyone in my family has seen it but me. Mm-hmm. So one day soon, I'm going to see it in 3D IMAX.
Before
at least
you're
going to
see it and you're going to be like, wait, this is totally different.
You know, do you ever get notes from your family after they've actually seen it in a movie? Like, you know.
No. You know, the only person really qualified to do that in my family would be my wife.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And, you know, she's definitely a tough critic. And that's why I love playing my stuff for her.
You have to. You need someone like that.
When she says, you know what, that's great. I love that. It happens pretty rarely, so it really means something. Mm-hmm. She doesn't, you know, go into, oh, I don't know about this cue. Mm-hmm. Could you have gone to A flat instead of A? Like, whatever. Nothing quite like that.
So she doesn't throw any bouquets, but when you get them, they're pretty good.
Has she said that lately?
She's a composer and a songwriter as well. Mm-hmm. My 9-year-old daughter is a violinist. And a pianist. In fact, she played a couple of pieces on the Frozen score.
Nice.
I brought her to sit with the violin section.
Wow.
Which was
probably
great.
Very happy about that.
So I predict in a few years I'll be getting those from her.
You're like, what have I done?
But if it's good for your daughter, then, you know, it's good for the rest of the community.
Yeah.
Young girl community.
Was there any piece recently that you've done that they were really wowed by or like...
Oh, you mean my family?
Mm-hmm.
Frozen, I guess, for my daughter in particular. Mm. My son said to me, after he saw Edge of Tomorrow, I said, so did you hear any music? Did you pay attention to any music? We've talked a little bit about music and how it works in movies and how if the movie is really good, it's okay to not remember the music and it's okay to not focus on the music, just be involved with the story. Mm. So he was like, I really liked the movie, so I didn't really get to hear much of it, but definitely heard a couple moments that were classic dad.
How old is your son?
He's 13.
13, classic dad.
Yeah. He's heard a few of my scores, I guess, and some of my isms shown through.
Mm-hmm. They have a musically involved family.
Yes, very much. My wife is a great pianist, and our living room is basically a music room. And there's just a lot of music being played in our house all the time. We have like a little, almost like a band room instead of a living room, where anytime someone feels like it, they can just sit in front of a drum set and play or something like that. So we play family band every once in a while, reenact Partridge Family.
The next
jam
film.
Sessions.
Oh, that's way before your time.
No, I still got Partridge Family. I know that stuff. I wanted to get to, because we brought up Frozen a little bit, you have done, your repertoire film is ginormous.
Yeah.
You guys can go on his website. There's like literally over 30 films, and I just don't even understand how you have time for this.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I want to talk a little bit about how you do choose projects and how, because I think, this year alone, we've seen Frozen, we've seen Edge of Tomorrow, completely different genres, completely different working environments. What makes you sign on to a project, or what do you find interesting, or what compels you to join?
Well, honestly, usually what gets me to sign on to a project is a job offer. it's definitely now post Frozen, let's say, I am enjoying a little bit more freedom to pick and choose. But even then, it's difficult because it's very important, as you guys know and have probably discussed, careers in Hollywood are built on relationships. And so I have to really give priority to any director I've worked with who wants to work with me again, especially ones I like. You know, whatever their next movie is, I'm doing whatever it is. It's difficult to really pick and choose in that way. And prior to Frozen as well, without an amazing credit like that to have, you know, you're at the mercy of what what the people who hire composers are intending to do, and whether they want to hire you than you are. Just, yeah, I think I'll do that one, that one, that one, and that one. But avoiding being typecast is something that I'm always thinking about. And, you know, maybe after doing a whole bunch of comedies, I'll let my agents know, hey, you know, I'm getting a little bit sick of comedies. Can we
do something else?
Can we do something else? Can we look at some other options? You know, I don't mind taking a pay cut, whatever. And we try to get creative about ways to break out of that.
And you've done it. I mean, we were talking earlier.
I think you've avoided it. Crazy Stupid Love. I mean, it's not Frozen either.
Well, I find this amazing. I'm going to repeat it again because I think it's incredible. He has the highest grossing R-rated comedy with The Hangover. And now the highest grossing animated film, like, typecast. I don't see it. I don't see it happening. Edge of Tomorrow. Things are happening.
It's Midas Beck here.
And your music definitely covers so many different demographics as well. I mean, you have Frozen with the younger kid demographic, and then you had Buffy, which catered to the teenage, and then you have the adults with Hangover. So your music covers so many different audiences, and I think that's amazing for any composer. You can be more well-rounded in that way.
But despite not wanting to be typecast, do you have a favorite? Oh.
Well, you know, I want to do things I've never done. I want to do a horror movie. Although I worry that, I mean, depending on the type of approach they want to go with the score, I could have pretty splitting headaches by the end of the day listening to this crazy, noisy stuff. You know, I'd love to do...
you need, like, a beautiful horror story.
Maybe one with some lyricism or a romantic love story. You know, I've done a couple of those, but it'd be nice to do another one. You know, I will say this. I've done a lot of comedies, and there have been times in my career when I was really sick of doing comedies. But they have mercifully low amounts of score in them, just in terms of a pure labor standpoint. Edge of Tomorrow has twice as many minutes of score as your average comedy. Wow. So it's a lot more work.
Sure.
But you know, like I said earlier, for the right project, if I get excited about something, the work, you know, doesn't matter how much work it is.
I wanted to ask you about USC and Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love his work, and he's been around. I mean, he's talk about a career. But geez. What was that experience like? What was it like working with Mike Post and, you know, getting set up to do Vampire and all those things?
Sure. Well, Jerry was only taught for 1 year, and that was the year that I was at USC.
Yeah.
And he taught my class. One of my classmates, Marco Beltrami, is very successful as well, and he was in that class. And there's three or four other really successful TV video game composers that come out of that class. Jerry was amazing, mainly because of his sense of how to make a lot out of a little. He can construct an entire piece of music out of a three-note motif, for example. And he would show us in his pieces how that's all related. It's almost, you know, like the way Beethoven would spin a whole 10-minute piece out of three notes, most famously in the Fifth Symphony.
Sure.
So it really gives his music a cohesiveness and a sense of a journey from beginning to end, because it's all related. And I take that very seriously when I do my stuff, too. I'm always thinking about that, you know. All right, it's time for a new idea here. Now, before I actually dive in and start, oh, this is cool, this isn't cool, I'm like, okay, is there something else from something I've already written that I can rework in some way just to give
that could inform this piece now to keep it some sort of continuity.
Just to give it some connective tissue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Mike was amazing too. I worked with Mike as an intern after my year at SC. And a very different approach to to scoring for Jerry. Mm-hmm. Mike was the most efficient composer I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. First of all, master of the catchy tune. I mean, some of the themes he's written are so iconic now. Mm-hmm. And they're a pleasure to listen to, even if they're
Law
20
and Order
years
for
old.
Those of you don't know.
I mean, among dozens of others.
Exactly.
But I remember the first day of my internship, I sat down to watch him do this. He was scoring an episode of L.A. Law, and he, at the time, he was just writing pencil on paper, just sketching out ideas and then handing it off to someone who would go to the computer and make it all sound nice. But he would be finished scoring the show in less time than it would take you to sit down and watch it from beginning to end without stopping.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. He would have maybe, let's say,
What's
six...
What's a savant-like?
It's like, it is. Talent. Five or six pieces of music, let's say, in the whole show is not that much music, and each one's maybe 30 seconds, something like that. So he would just fast-forward the next spot, watch it once, and I'll just get an idea in his head, 30 seconds, a minute, and then... Writing it down. Okay, great. Next. Fast forward the next bit. Go. I was like, wow, that's amazing. That's just amazing to see someone who's so dialed in to their job to be able to do that.
This is like passing. I like get a song stuck in my head for like 3 days, and then I would like break out of that. I feel like if I wrote music, I'd be like, so the whole movie sounds like one thing.
Mike was also great in the room, like when he's presenting music to his clients. He really knew how to put on a show. He knew how to put on a show. He was, I remember, I still don't have the balls to do this with my clients, but he would make them listen to the important piece of music anyway, themes and big cues from movies. Listen three times, right? Okay, you're going to listen to it once at full volume. Now I'm going to turn it down. You're going to listen to it soft. Then I'm going to turn it up again, even louder. You're going to listen to it again. Okay, now do you like it? Sort of that thing. And that's kind of brilliant because a lot of times familiarity is what, you know, gets you used
to something.
To
get the, makes the hook. Yeah. Sets it. Wow, that's fascinating.
Chelsea had talent and passion for it as well. And I feel like you really have to have that in order to have a successful career.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. It's just too much craziness, you know, to not love it.
That's awesome. Well, I know we have a limited amount of time, but I got to ask about the Whiffen Puffs. What was that? When I saw that, I went, well, sure, it makes sense. I should have went to why not? But, you know, it's
That's an
the
old...
guy that you scored Edge of Tomorrow was the director of the Whiffen Puffs.
Yeah. So. By the way, I also scored Pitch Perfect.
There you go.
There is some connection.
Yeah, I forgot about that part, yeah.
No, they're of
by
course...
By the way, did they come to you specifically because...
No, they had no idea. But when I told them, they're like, whoa!
That's great.
Yeah. No, of course, it's a long-standing tradition. In fact, I was recently there, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago for the 100th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And there were like 800 of us still alive who all got together and sang. I mean, it was ridiculous and amazing. But that's, of course, for those in your audience who don't know, that's a sort of – the Whiffen Poofs are a very traditional, some would say stodgy – a cappella group out of Yale of seniors only, and it's kind of Yale is a big school for a cappella, and there's 13-14 groups, and then they're all feeder groups into the kind of all-star group, which is the Whiffen Poofs, which is only seniors. And I'll tell you right now, I was not selected to be in that group for my singing ability. Ironically enough, being the fact that it is a singing group, but basically I was the only one, you know, who could conduct.
Who could arrange and conduct. Yeah.
You're like, haha.
Well, you carried that standard of that tradition very well. So, congratulations on that. What's next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm working on another time travel movie.
Are you really?
Hot Tub Time Machine 2.
All right.
Nice. Not the one you were expecting.
They're going in the future this time, right?
They do go. Am I allowed to say that? You just did. So, yeah, they go into the future this time.
You can blame that spoiler alert on Marissa.
My bad. She let it go.
So, it's it's different musically. I mean, the music is all... first of all, the movie's ridiculous and silly and hilarious. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to be able to do a bit of a, you know, they went to the 80s. There were some 80s influences in the score. Now they go to the future. So I can just sort of pretend what music
whatever
from the future might sound like.
Be.
So there's a lot of bleeps and bloops and sparkly synthesizers.
So you've already kind of got a hook into that, or have you already done
this? I'm recording next
recording?
Week. I'm
oh,
just
wow,
about
okay.
done. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
How long in this one?
This was only like 6 weeks. Oh. This is nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pretty short and sweet.
Only about, again, about half the amount of music as in Edge of Tomorrow. There's a lot of songs in these movies, and every time there's a song, that means that's one piece of music I don't have to write. So, yeah.
Do you have more animated features coming up?
I do. I can't really say what it is yet, but there's a nice, really big one coming up for me at the end of 2015. It's still very early.
Nice.
A very exciting and daunting opportunity all at the same time. But they all feel that way, of course.
But you've kind of found slow discovery of love of animation, haven't you?
Yes, I have. The experience of working on Frozen was really amazing. And I think it comes from the fact that in live action, a lot of time, there's a bit of an us versus them with the filmmakers in the studio. The studio wants one thing, filmmakers want another, especially directors who really believe in their vision, and it's maybe not what the studio wants, but they feel so passionate about it, they just want to defend it. And you know, I get kind of caught in the middle because, you know, it's a studio that hires me, and my contract is with the studio, but it's the director who I...
You're working with them.
So it's very difficult sometimes.
Wow.
But at Disney Animation, that company is run by a filmmaker, and all the people who direct films, they come out of that organization. They start out as animators, not all, but most, they start out as animators. So they all come from a similar background. There's a kinship there, and there's a real feeling of a team working together to make something great instead of a battle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that is obviously a great environment for someone like me to be able to do great work.
Yeah.
On top of that, you also did the Disney Paper Man short animation.
Right.
Would you like to do more short animations too?
I'll do anything with Disney that they call me for. In fact, I've done I did something, another short for them. I don't know if it'll ever be released, but it was for a retailer's convention or maybe their marketing department or something for something they can show at conventions and gatherings of international Disney people. I really was never quite sure what it was for, but it was this beautiful...
They're always busy. They got lots of stuff to do.
It was this beautiful montage of all their animated films from their entire catalog, arranged in a very sweet way, and there was no sound in it except for the music, which is similar to Paper Man. The three projects I've done for Disney have all felt like amazing opportunities for music. Two of them having no sound in them except for music. So it's hard for me not to have a soft place in my heart for them.
I want
to
see that one.
We're going to have to leave it there. We want to thank you so much for coming by
and
giving us your insight into this film and as well as the things you have coming up. We can't wait to see them. We hope to have you back when those opportunities arise. And,
anytime. You guys are great.
I appreciate it very much. We're going to take a quick break here while we allow Christoph to head out, and then we'll come back and give our final thoughts of Edge of Tomorrow, and we'll see you soon.
We're back. Sorry for the break there, folks.
Well, it was great to have Christoph Beck in here. He was wonderful to listen to. I loved everything he had to say. It was very interesting. Anyway,
I think he's incredible. And before we get back into just doing a probably really fast rundown of Edge of Tomorrow, I do want to say that I think that he's done so many things.
Oh, my God.
And it's still very early in his career.
Yeah, that's what I was amazed
by. Like, oh my goodness, you've done, what is it? He said between 50 and 60 films.
I don't know what it
was. Plus TV shows.
Yeah.
And it really has not been that many years. So I think, and he already has hits like Frozen, these big blockbusters. I think we're going to see amazing things from him. I'm excited to hear his music, and I think his variety is fantastic.
He's definitely going to go down as one of the composers up there with John Williams, Hans Zimmer, like all those
humongous
names.
Even surpass Jerry Goldsmith, who knows?
Yeah. It's incredible. But back to Edge of Tomorrow.
Here we go. Yeah.
Dive in.
Okay. Since we have very limited time, what do we want to speak to first? Let me ask you this then. Anything glaring that you thought was fabulous or anything that you wanted to... what was this? Go ahead.
I think this is kind of a character/career move that I just have to acknowledge that I went into this movie partly doubting it because of Tom Cruise. I thought that this was just going to be your average run-of-the-mill. Let's throw a big, like, tons of explosions. Mm-hmm. Let's make it big and grand, and that's going to carry the weight of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. For me, it was really the character development.
Yeah.
And he earned a lot of fanship back from me that he hasn't really had in years. Just from
he's had challenging times, public experience, and even some of the movies that haven't done as well in the States that they've done internationally. But he's been, you know, but for 30 years or so, he's been a huge major star.
But
in the last few years,
that star power showed through on this, and the fact that they started him off as
the
a coward,
completely
that they had him start off not as like the top guy, not
they
as the guy
gave
who's
him
coming
a
to save
decent
the world,
arc,
but they gave him the oh, you really don't want to do this, and the earning this, and the like. I liked that it wasn't just like, oh, they're in love with each other when they're only having one day. I liked that it was kind of complicated, and there was like an affection growing for me on his point, and like she kind of felt it, but it wasn't like, oh, they're in love.
Yeah, it was. They didn't force that so much because it wasn't. Yeah. They just didn't have the time to do that, and I think that was a smart choice not to force it to make the possibility of it at the end.
They had a bigger story going on too that they have to deal with, the bigger objective, the overall big picture.
Along with him starting off as a coward, because clearly he was, and I thought he would do great in those scenes with Brendan Gleeson, you know, bumping into the chair, the whole thing, and then running. I mean, totally, completely playing against type, which I thought was a great choice. I also thought there's some vicarious thrill for people who not as big as fans or not of seeing Tom just bludgeoned and beaten and stuff because he gets killed so many different ways and different times. That's what people go, yeah, right on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that adds to the vulnerability of his character too. That's someone that we can actually enjoy, not just because he's getting killed, because he is human and adding those characters. And I was never off of the Tom Cruise bandwagon. Like, I always liked him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had some hit and misses with his movies.
What
but
star wouldn't?
It's okay.
I mean, if you put up his career against everybody else, everybody has not so good movies. But for 30 years, the guy's been a bona fide movie star. The top one ever.
He's been a crazy name.
But like, I also thought that playing against time, we just talked about the playing against type thing was great, but there's something about the fact that because you know he's going to reset, that you don't, you can have fun with him getting killed. You can have fun with, I mean, they obviously did with, oh, we'll just have to reset, boom,
again?
Pop him in the head. And,
again.
Oh,
again.
You broke your leg. No, I can feel my toes. Bang! You know, I mean, that stuff is, how much fun can you have with it? That's great. That's
wonderful. And then another point I want to give them credit to, I know we're zipping kind of through this, but is that I thought they made a lot of things very simple. Mm-hmm. And to me, it worked. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes it causes a lot of questions. But the fact that the whole world was being taken over by these aliens, and that the aliens kind of existed on these three levels, and they explained them concisely with one being the claws, one being the alphas, and it being the brain. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. And it was just a race that was here to take over for whatever reason they needed, and they were going to get it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, I like this tiered aspect. Yeah. I like that in one area it gives us conflicts because we can't kill any alphas. Mm-hmm. It also gives us this mission because we have to find the center and we have to find these claws. And I was like, that works. That works very well for me. I was just
A lot of people didn't have any issues with that. Some of them had other issues with it, but I think that those three tier thing was good. But people had some challenges. Why are they here? I didn't quite get that. No, they're just here to learn how to be human so they can learn how to take over worlds elsewhere.
It seemed like they were called mimics. What I got from it, from a couple different scenes putting things together, was that the mimics came. It was a race of aliens that obviously has perfected the domination of worlds. There was the one section in the bar where it was like, well, I say they're here for minerals. Mm-hmm. And I say they're here. And Tom Cruise gives the line, you know
the
what?
The difference doesn't make.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. They're going to kill us. And I was like,
I appreciate it. And I was of the same thing. Well, it doesn't matter. They're trying to kill you. Who cares? Why? Why do you have to understand? You know,
and it was
point,
kind of nice that they did that. And there wasn't this whole other subplot in this time travel story where they were like, oh, but the mimics are really trying to do this. And we didn't get like the scenes of
and
mimics.
I've often said, if you're having problems, if you really can't plug all your plot holes, and you pretty much have to use speed to get through them. So by the time people go, wait a minute, what was that? You're already gone to the next thing. So they did a great job of keeping the thing moving.
Yeah, speaking of the next thing, I loved how they used that device to their storytelling and how they progressed forward, even though they kept resetting. But because when we went to another new location, we would slowly learn that, oh, we've already been here, even though the audience hasn't been there. And then, like,
you learn either we had been there or we hadn't.
Yeah,
we didn't know
that.
Until,
more little details. They're like, okay, at this point, the audience can already assume that they've lived this day at least once or twice. Yeah. So, and I liked how they just kept forwarding the story along, and that didn't bother me. They're like, this is somewhere new, I want to know, but that doesn't really matter because we've already been there.
Yeah, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. The only thing I wanted more of was at the ending. I wanted a bigger ending.
Okay.
And I'm not the only one who said that. There's a lot of people who said mm-hmm. it just kind of fizzled there at the end. And it did to me because, you know, he pulls the – I love the imagery that the hand grenades go down. You see the five pins or whatever, the hand grenade pins come out of his hand and stuff like that. And obviously Omega blows up and then everything else just kind of goes boop. It just kind of – I'm like –
Well, you know, he gets coated in blood, and then he goes
no,
back.
No, I understand it. I mean, it makes sense logically. It's just kind of like, oh, okay.
It was but a little way of making it. Mm-hmm. It made it a little pretty at the end.
Pretty at the end.
Like, well, his first death with the alpha wasn't pretty, and then this one was kind of poetic in a way that he's actually this is a death that he wanted,
right?
To end this. You know, race of mimics, but I thought it was very reminiscent of the War of the Worlds
movie. I didn't like that one with the grenade
that he put in the first one and that destroyed all the others.
Oh, you were talking about when you were talking about this scene, I thought you meant you were talking about pretty much the chunk after.
I am talking about the chunk after
where he goes back and all of a sudden everyone's alive again. He's just never met them, and then he has the opportunity to fall in love.
No, that part was great. The girl. I like the one thing I missed from the ending was I wanted that moment for her. Because, you know, we end on him laughing and the cute little grin of his. But we never get to see her realization that we did it. And I know because each time he would have to explain to her, I'm not saying that we needed to have a moment where he goes, hey, we did it. We won the whole thing. But there's a moment because of who she is. She knows at some point.
She will find out that they met.
And you spent so much time with her. I wanted her to have that moment. And I felt like, oh, I wanted to see her. Because she could have carried that moment. She's a good enough actress. Well, you wouldn't have to say anything. You could have seen her understand it from the get-go just by the way he's looking at her. I think you could have done it. And I think it would have been really successful
for me.
It is
an interesting scene that I would like to see. It would just, I know it would have been hard for that. It would have been
hard. It would have been hard, but I would have seen it. And I just felt like because I had spent so much time with her and was invested in her, that I wanted her to have some sort. And I know it's going to happen. It's just we didn't get to see it on screen. I'm just saying on screen, it would have been nice to see. So, and the other question I have is, you know, if the alphas can reset, why can't the omega? When it dies, can it just reset?
Because it's not like an active being. It's like a brain.
Okay.
Like I don't know. If you think about
it, somehow
omega,
the alphas can.
Like,
the alphas can do something that the omega can't. I'm sure somebody out there has a wonderfully logical explanation for it.
If you think
maybe
about
it knows
omega
it's a guy
is,
and then just wouldn't attack that. I don't know.
No, but if you think about it, omega means end. I don't think
it would
be the beginning. And alpha is the beginning. So it makes sense that the alphas would go back to the beginning, but omega would go back to the end.
I just found that whole thing.
It has
thing
a definitive
odd.
Like
something under you has an ability you don't have. That is very interesting. My plot hole for the thing is that, and it's hard when you have so many material, is that why no one recognized Tom Cruise? That's the thing I don't understand.
Oh, his character.
Because he's the mouthpiece for the entire United Defense Force. He just talked about, they set it up that he was the media face of all of them who got all these recruits to be in suits.
Yeah, exactly. And nobody recognizes
him. And none of the people in the suits know who he is.
He's not a very good mouthpiece. He's been all over the news everywhere.
Yes.
But none of these grunts recognize him.
Yes.
He's their spokesperson, but none of them recognize him.
And like he was the one who convinced them to join, but no one knows who he is.
That's great.
I was like,
I didn't even pay attention. I think that's one of the best things I've heard.
Like, come
that's
on.
Great.
There's some sort of thing. So
he actually makes that argument that I've convinced all these
He's like, I got you, like, whatever, 1.5 million.
Who recognizes the recruiting officer? That's beyond me. Although he is all over CNN and all the other networks. Yeah,
that was mine.
That's
like,
a very good one.
Hey, hold up.
I don't know of anybody that's brought that up with you, and certainly no one's answered it, but that's a really good one.
Yeah. If you guys can answer that for me.
My question was at the very end, when we know that Gage could... you know, start the whole day over again, even though everyone's gone. Mm-hmm. My question is, when he eventually dies, when he's an older man, gentleman, and he dies, will he reset?
I know, because, he's got the blood in him. So that's what the other thing I was going is he's going to have to relive his life all over again.
Is he immortal?
I don't know. That's what's, it's an interesting question. So that's what always you get into with these time travel things.
This is the sequel.
Yeah.
Instead of Edge of Tomorrow, it's... I don't even know.
Yesterday? Hey. Well, no, okay. But, you know, a lot of people have praised it because even though it's taken from a book, it's not a sequel to any other piece. Mm-hmm. So they're liking that part of it. Mm-hmm. And we have to ask, why is it not doing better? Because, I mean, it's getting very good reviews. It's getting great audience response. Obviously, it got killed by A Fault in Our Stars.
I don't know if that's a detriment to Edge of Tomorrow or just a...
Well,
people went to Fault for Our Stars.
Well, they have totally different demographics. They're 80% of the people went to Fault for the Stars were women under the age of 25. And 80% of the people that went to Edge of Tomorrow were guys over the age of 25 or 70% or so. So that's totally different demographics. So I don't know that, I mean, it's counter programming, so to speak. So I don't know that they really affected each other, but certainly the movie going public did not go, I mean, they went in decent. I mean, it's made what, I don't know what the budget was, $178 million. They put $100 million into it for P&A. And as of the 11th, it's made $150 million or so worldwide.
Let's look about it. I have
so
it.
It's doing well.
While you're looking that up, if you think about it too,
great.
We haven't had a lot of female-driven films yet this summer. I mean, we've had The Other Woman, but we've already had a lot of action summer blockbusters already come out. And then this feels like another one just to add to that roster. Mm-hmm. And then Fault of Our Stars is definitely one out of a handful just that are catered towards the women demographic. So I can understand why women might go to this one more so than the men going to just another action film.
Yeah, right, you can understand women going to Edge of Tomorrow?
The Fault of Our
Stars.
Okay,
see, I can see women going to see Edge of Tomorrow because I thought Emily Blunt did fabulous, and she's the warrior.
The thing is,
she's
this movie, and it is, by the way, worldwide right now, 151 point almost 5 million.
Okay, so there you go.
But I think that it's a hidden gem in a way. As much as it's a huge blockbuster movie,
you think word of mouth will carry it?
I hope so.
I think it has been.
But here's what it's up against this week. I mean, it's got the two of them, How to Train Your Dragon, and what's the other one?
That's up. I'm really just focused on How to Train Your Dragon.
Jump Street.
That's it. They're both getting amazing reviews already. And so will it, and Maleficent and Fault of Our Stars.
But also, those two films coming out this week, those are sequels. People have already seen the original, so they're going to want to go see. If they love the original, they're going to go see the second one. This one is one completely in and of itself.
I have to say, I hope word of mouth is strong, because I think it deserves to be so. It's certainly better than Godzilla Transcendence, as you mentioned earlier.
And as much as advertising as they have done for this film, I was so surprised not only by the fact that I liked it so much, but also by what it was.
Yeah, because you didn't know.
This whole time, I did. I expected it to be the Tom Cruise is the hero, Emily Blunt kind of tags along. Yeah. And then the fact that it is her character so different than female characters we see, and I know that's one of the reasons she liked this role, was because she did want to be an action hero who was not being guided.
Leading.
Exactly.
Yeah, she was leading.
So, and I think that was done really well, but not described in the advertising.
Yeah.
I think that the arc that Tom Cruise was done very well, but not described in the advertising. Right. So, to me, so much of what makes this movie good is hidden.
Yeah. And even the humor is hidden because you don't expect it to be anywhere near as funny as it is. And it's not like it's a laugh riot throughout the movie, but the humor is done very well strategically and just
Trade of Ways to Die, getting crushed by a truck. I mean, everyone laughed at that. Yeah. Like, what were you thinking?
Yeah, that's funny.
I mean, I love
when
just
he rolls
the little
under
moments.
And they didn't show it either. I mean, you just heard it and saw it. I mean, didn't see it. It's great. It's terrific. So
we have
labor.
To tell everyone.
And you have to say, Doug Liman does a fabulous job. I mean, he had challenges, as he does in every movie, apparently. I mean, you know, even from the first one, Swingers, he had, you know, his issues there. But it put together a great movie.
Mm-hmm. I thought the weaponry was also fascinating, too.
The suit,
the exoskeleton.
Yeah, what do they call it?
And that they actually made it, and it wasn't CGI.
I mean,
yeah,
70
no.
of them in all different versions.
They made so many. And in an interview of Emily Blunt, she said hers weighed about 85 pounds.
Yeah, and the heavier version weighed 130 pounds, and hers, the one she was wearing, was 85.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And
like, think about it.
During training, Emily Blunt would wear
a weighted
vest. That's
like two-thirds of her.
That's like more than two-thirds of her. She's tiny.
She weighs like 180, 130. That's two-thirds of her.
Yeah, but during training, she would wear a weighted vest so she can get used to the weight and lugging that around. And also, getting in and out of the suits originally took around 30 minutes, and you know, being on set, every minute counts.
Yeah, you can't do that.
And so they had to cut that time down to, and they actually managed it because they had a team of four people getting people in and out, and they cut that time down to 30 seconds.
And that's they had crazy. Special rigs built so that they could, when they were cut, they could hold them up so the weight was off them. That's great.
I think it was also a good choice that they did make these real.
I don't know how you could have
so much.
Yeah, they were great.
Such a dynamic, and the suits were interesting. And to me,
and which one of you? I would want those things. Who didn't? I mean, push a car, you know.
Yeah, they're supposed to, you know, make you run faster, punch harder, and like really elevate every human physical ability.
But as much as they did, it was also. And as much as it was a suit of armor, it was minimalistic in a way. Like, it wasn't fully coated. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like you could just see their face, exposed. Which we've seen so much.
Took the helmet
it
off,
is just like these bars, and I really liked that.
Yeah,
I thought
that was great. Very effective.
Mm-hmm. And also, just a fun fact, ExoBionics is actually working on an exoskeleton to help paraplegics walk again.
Yeah, I've seen those.
A lot of inspiration for that suit and for everything is coming from
stuff that's already have
projects
that are
being made, like things that they want to do, and that's why it read well. Mm-hmm. It didn't like it read that this was as much as like the aliens were very futuristic and crazy.
They were
like,
great. I loved that. I thought the alpha. I thought that was really effective because when that alpha opened its mouth and you see the heat vaporizing, it's like, oh, that is nasty.
That was blue.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was awful.
Yeah, and just a little bit on the handguns too. Mm-hmm. They're actually military real weapons that they based it off. Mm-hmm. The gun that Rita uses to shoot Gage over and over again, it was a Sig Sauer P226R, which is
such tech talk from Marissa.
Yeah, which is actual real gun, and the sound that they used was actually recorded from the actual gun.
Yeah,
so there we go. Did you guys have sorry for you guys out there that we didn't get to dive too much in this movie because we had a wonderful interview, which I think is a very good exchange. So conversation, definitely continue with us through comments. Do you guys have any like favorite scenes or moments from this film?
I have a few. I like the first time Gage is out there with the mechanical monsters trying to, and he just gets the crap kicked out of him. And I really do love the one where he's hobbling away and she said, you broke your leg. No, I can still feel my toes, and bam, she just shoots him.
I think that it was funny that one of my funniest or favorite scenes was when they really got into the repetition at the beach, and because I've never really seen repetition done quite that way, where often it's like, oh, I'm frustrated, but they get the hang of things so easily,
right?
But it's like, in this one, it was literally one step forward. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, oh, the third time you did it, you made it all the way through. Mm-hmm. Great. Like, it really was ingrained into you. Like, they're like, one step.
Exactly.
Oh, we did it and it was wrong again. Like,
turn left, duck right.
Yeah. Or that it was like her struggling with turning left or whatever it was, like five times, and that she still couldn't get it.
Be specific.
Yeah. That, to me, read so well. And that scene was so, like, frustrating and new and well done. That was my favorite.
Yeah, I think another fun favorite scene of mine was when, using the same device, when they're going to Gleason's character to get the transponder again.
Yeah.
But this is the first time the audience has seen it, but we've already been there.
Mm-hmm.
But the blocking and how simple, turn this way.
Right.
And, you know, spin this way and, like, avoid these two people going through the elevator. And you know, that was brilliant. And that was so simple. But you can...
Even when the obvious, don't shoot him this time. You know, oh, okay, they've tried that route.
But so. It was so simple but still comedic at the same way. And I really like that.
That's another point. I understand why they did it action-wise. But logic-wise, I went, okay, so he's going to give you the transponder. And then he's going to have everybody hunt you down. What's the point of that?
It was like... I think it was to go back to...
Logic-wise, it makes no sense. But I understand how it works movie-wise because it's nice in action, but you could have thought a better way in.
Also, for me, like motivation-wise, it tied into his earlier interaction with Cruz, where it was the same thing, where it was that kind of misguided, like, I'm not going to attack you right on. I'm going to let other people do it.
Yeah, but why would you
it?
Give that device up? It was important enough for you to keep in a safe, but you're just going to hand it over to this guy.
He also had a gun on him. But this is what I'm saying. It's just that, like, earlier on we saw him with Tom Cruise. Yeah. I'm not saying you're completely wrong, because you have to do all this connecting yourselves, which isn't always the best solution. And I have to, like, tweak it in my head for it to work. But earlier we saw him, like, you get Tom Cruise blackmailing him. Mm-hmm. And then he leaves and he's like, oh, well, now that there's all these armed guards on, he's like, now arrest him. And to me, it was kind of a callback to that, where it's like, you think everything's fine. You think Tom Cruise has his way, but really he's not into it. Mm-hmm. There you go. And to me, it was just like this guy who's like, you can give things to people now, and then you can strip them away either.
Of all the choices you can, because they could have found another way into the safe. They could have stolen the thing, and then he could have, as they're running away, the same thing could have happened, but it just like, what? This makes no sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got to get to our last thoughts because we got to get out of here. So, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just, my last thought, I thought it was really well done for an action film and a nonlinear film, because I'm just such a big fan of those, because it always makes me think every single time, and, you know, I'm going to reiterate my opinions, but it was really brilliantly well done, and I think more people will go see this film.
I hope so.
Because
I think
it's
deserves
really
a lot.
Word of mouth.
Yeah, for my final thought, I'm even going to put it so far as, like, there's a lot of great movies out right now, or a lot of movies that have a lot of publicity, and I thought this movie was well worth seeing, and obviously, hopefully you guys did too. So out there, it's like, this is a word of mouth movie. So this is like kind of like our responsibility to tell people about and be like, no, that is worth seeing.
Yeah.
And they really were wearing those suits.
Yeah.
There's just so much to like about this film. Yeah. I mean, yeah, everybody has these little nitty gritty things.
Now, the fun fact, Emily.
Who wouldn't? I mean,
Emily,
that's part of what
Blunt
we do here.
Almost broke her nose during filming.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, the onset physician had to straighten it out.
Nice.
Another fun little fact about her before we go.
Yep.
During reshoots, she had done a lot of her stunts in a lot of training. Mm-hmm. And then for reshoots, she had a lot of someone else do her stunts.
Yeah, she didn't want to.
And that was because she was pregnant. And
right.
Tom Cruise ended up being one of the first people she trusted with that information.
Well, because, yeah.
I'm
sure he kept wondering, well, why are you doing your stunts now? You did them before. Because he's the one that called her a wuss when she
first. Well, because Tom Cruise is famous for doing his own stunts.
Absolutely.
So congrats to her out there as well.
It's a great movie. Go see it. You'll have a lot of fun. You may have every time travel movie has its own little issues, but you got to buy into it. But don't worry about that part. It's a fun movie. Enjoy
it. But if you do have any plot holes, please tell us about
them. Absolutely. Like Sarah's. All right. Where can they find AOM people?
You can follow all of us here at Anatomy of a Movie on Twitter at Movie Anatomy, on our website, anatomyofamovie.com.
And where can they find you?
Oh, they can find me here at Anatomy of a Movie, or on AfterBuzz TV, Game of Thrones, or Penny Dreadful.
All right.
Which we do together.
We want to thank you for listening. Again, we also want to thank Maria Menounos and the Evergirls Guide to Diet and Fitness for hosting this particular event. Thank you very much. Check that out. It's a New York Times bestseller. You can find it everywhere.
And thank
Please
you, Christopher
check that
Beck.
Out. Thank you, Christopher Beck, for joining us. It was fabulous to talk to you. We hope to have you back. And congratulations on all your success and your continued success. On behalf of everybody here, we want to thank you very much for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.